Welcome to Now in Zen, the podcast about microtonal and Zen harmonic music, both national and international, foreign and domestic, past, present, and future, for JI purists, computer geeks, alternative guitarists, and academic aficionados of all ages, from age 8 to 81 over 64. I'm Steven Weigel.
I'm Sevish.
And this is Now in Zen. Today we're here with Elaine Walker, who is a popular musician featured in the space band Zia, and she's done a lot of work with Bolan Pierce. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, let's talk about the Bolan Pierce scale and how you use it, because you are so good at coming up with chord progressions and things like that, and you've got some of the modes named after you. So what are some of the strategies that you use when you play in Bolan Pierce and all of that kind of stuff?
As far as composing in Bolan Pierce, the only strategy I can say is that I'm very careful. I usually compose one note at a time, and then I'll add another note, and then I'll add another note. So I would say composing more horizontally than just trying to bang out some chords.
Okay.
I'm aware of the minor thirds thing you get stuck in. Aware of. So I pretty much completely avoid, first, I'll completely avoid the shrunken octave, as I call it, or any other really bad sounding intervals. And then later on in the composition, maybe try to actually use those on purpose for some tension. But just to be really careful and take a really long time doing it, because it's going to leave an impression forever for people that listen to it. That's going to be their impression of Bolan Pierce, you know, at least part of it. Yeah. So just to take some care. I had 12-tone theory my whole entire life, from first grade up until grad school. And
of course,
even when I used to compose in 12-tone, I would throw all that out the window. It's not that I would throw it out the window on purpose. It's just a complete disconnect in my brain somehow. Like some wiring is missing.
And so
I just composed by ear, no matter how much of an expert I would become in music theory. So it just lends itself I might as well compose in microtonal scales because it doesn't matter to me. I end up just doing it by ear. So, yeah, it's up to you guys to... it's up to Steven to analyze what chord progressions I use.
Thank you for recognizing that I'm equally as, you know, unable to analyze my own stuff as you are.
I'm well still done. Trying to get over the fact that I'm talking to Sevish. Sean Sevish.
Yes, Sean Hello. Archibald himself. Can I say a real name? Is that all right?
I'm a fan of the interviewer.
It's known.
Well, Steven, I'm your fan too. You know that, but I already know you, so.
Yes. We played together at Microtonal Adventures Festival 2018, so that was really fun.
I miss going to all these fests and things. You know, I've been to two of them, but there's not so much stuff happening.
You Skyped into that one.
Yeah, I Skyped into that one, but it would have been really cool to have actually been there as well. Kind of awkward when everyone else was in the same place, you know, and I was like the screen.
Yeah, but I was on an airplane on the way back, unfortunately, so I missed that.
Yeah, so this is our first time actually speaking face to face, right? Well, like Skype to Skype.
Yeah.
Popular messaging client too.
So I know Sean, but only over email.
Yeah. Well, no, it's cool. Your music, Elaine, was like one of the first microtonal stuff that I really got into.
Me too. Seconded.
It may be the case for quite a few of us that get into it. We discover Zia and like, oh, this is really cool.
Yeah. You know, Love Us, the Catalyst is one of my favorite Zia songs. I show that to people, and since it's 10 EDO and you use like one bass note in the beginning, maybe with the perfect fifth, you know, people don't know it's enharmonic right away, or it alternates between two chords. And then you hit that neutral triad with like the arpeggio. And if you haven't heard it before, that's like really shocking. Yeah. And
is it that one you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I got to make that joke when I performed that song on stage at the festival. When I performed that at University of California, Santa Barbara, which was before that one, I got to make that joke about, okay, everyone, here's my keyboard that I'm playing. It's 10 notes per octave, and I have it arranged so the black notes are this triad. And I played the triad, and so I got to say, is it major or minor? And they're all major, minor, major, minor, major, murmur, murmur, major, minor. And I'm like, wrong!
Great question!
It's exactly in between.
That's fantastic. That's cool.
Well,
yeah.
Elaine, just wondering, when did you first become aware of alternative tunings? And how did you get started using them in your own music?
Well, when I was really little, taking piano lessons, or it could have been pre-piano lessons, I remember asking Mom at the piano, hey, Mom, what about the notes in between? What are these all the notes? Why are there just these notes? And then she said something about, oh, well, the history of it, or the, you know, she's a mathematician. So I think she said, well, it started with like Pythagoras coming up with intervals. And then we just eventually adapted it. So by Mozart's time, we pretty much adapted this like major minor thing. And that was good enough for me all the way up until college. And it was towards the end of my undergrad, and Dr. Boulanger from Berklee College of Music was my main professor. And to this day, I owe a lot of the direction of my life to his mentorship. So in his composition, electronic music composition class, we walked in one day and he had the DAT machine set up, and he said, I'm going to play a composition in the Boulin-Pierce scale. And then he proceeded to sing along, which no one was expecting him to sing. So a lot of the class was kind of just shocked by, oh, he's singing. And so they're like, but it was so beautiful. I was freaking out. Like all my hair stood on end. I got the chills. I'm like, what is happening to my brain right now? He was singing in the Boulin-Pierce scale, just completely out of the blue. Like there's notes from outer space. What is happening? And so after that, I'm like, Dr. B, I'm never going to write in the 12-tone scale again. Like, what is this? So he knew. When I taught electronic music for 10 years, there was a rare student, you know, maybe once a year, there would be one student that would be interested in it. And I'd kind of latch onto that student and show him the hexagon keyboard and try to get him into it. So I was that student for him.
Yeah.
So he got me. He said, Well, young lady, you might want to start with 19 notes per octave instead of the Boulin-Pierce scale. So he had me, got me set up.
That's good.
See, that's what we needed to know last week when we did what are the best beginner scales. So 19 apparently worked for you, right?
Yeah, I said that one because it has a diatonic scale, like 12. And if you play something diatonic in 19... some people might not even be able to tell the difference. But yeah, Boulin-Pierce is a lot more Zenharmonic, and since it doesn't have octaves in it, then a lot of things sound really, really alien all the time. So, yeah. I think
you
it's
can't do
fascinating
the normal
how
things.
You got into it.
You can't do normal things like double up on a bass line. There's only one of every note.
Yeah.
Oh, don't get me started on the bass lines in Boulin-Pierce. Yeah, I totally agree. You can't do that, and it's so troublesome.
But most people don't care. So I've asked the community here and there, like, so, you know, what do we do about that issue? I just assume we're not supposed to. Because sometimes on the synthesizer, the sound will be transposed down an octave and another sound will be transposed up an octave. And I'm like, oh, Boulin-Pierce, you're not allowed. So we got to get the bass same octave as a high bell sound and then just use whatever notes are available at that point. Well, whenever I mention stuff like this, most microtonalists say, oh, are you kidding me? Just do whatever. No one's going to care. Just He can cheat. Yeah. So yeah, I have in my Drum and Bass album, I think it's Greater Good. It's one of the Bolan Pierce ones. There's one cheater note. And I still feel guilty about it.
The tablature.
You shouldn't. Don't feel guilty about that. I do that on every single Bolan Pierce track. I just, it's because the everything else makes sense.
Yeah.
Everything else makes sense except for the bass and the sub bass. I feel like the octave is so important there, really, to get that solid sound. And you can't have something right. like a tritave down below the bass, because then it's like really wobbly.
You have to have a tritave sub bass. So. Now you guys are making me say tritave.
yeah, sorry about that.
Tritave. I keep forgetting. Well, Elaine's way is the best way, I think.
Tritive, right?
So wait, tritive. Is that how you say it? Tritive?
But I'm American, you know. They probably say it different over there.
I've been saying tritave. I've been finding out that all these internet words that I've only read from the microtonal community, I'm saying them all wrong, and everyone else has decided to say it the right way. So I'm trying to talk more correctly, I guess.
Well,
so
some people say EDO. I always say EDO, and I notice people say EDO.
I used to say EDO, and now I say EDO because of Sevish here, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's your
fault. Oh, you started that?
Oh, yeah. You know what? The last two episodes, I've been doubting my pronunciation of Scala, because I always say Scala, and you say Scala.
Scala.
And then I saw your video the other day, and you doubted yourself, and you were like, Scala? Scala? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I just felt really
not...
proud of making you, you know, doubt yourself there.
First Edo, and then Scala. What's next? I can't even think of another word, but I'm sure there are a lot. Funny temperament names that are named after people and animals colliding, like Arjean or whatever. Those are cool.
Well, I'm open now because I grew up saying T-E-T or Tet, you know, that whole, which was really annoying. I'm glad in retrospect that T-E-T changed to E-D-O, because it used to be 19 tone equal temperament. So just alone, tone equal temperament doesn't stand alone as its own phrase. You can't just say tone equal temper. It has to be a number, tone equal temperament, whereas equal division of the octave makes more sense because you can say it by itself and it still is a meaningful phrase. But I had all my CDs, all my websites, everything everywhere labeled T-E-T because, you know, I'm a stickler for labeling every song I write. I want everyone to know what tuning each song is in and nobody else. Sometimes Sevish does.
What do you mean sometimes?
Do you always label them?
I put mine in the liner notes, though. I never put them in file names or anything like that.
I put them in the file name. I put it there so no one can miss it. Because that's what I
want
to know.
That naive experience.
I want to know what I'm listening to when I listen to other people's music. So I'm trying to set a precedent, but no one listens to me, you know?
I do. I think your music's amazing, and I actually copied you. I do that exact same thing with my songs. I also put my tunings in parentheses, although this is an interesting issue, actually, whether microtonalists should say that they are, you know, using their tunings, but maybe we're a little bit biased, us three, since we all put our tunings in. I know a few microtonalists, or at least I think a few microtonalists, are pretty passionate about not putting the tunings in so people won't be biased in... Anyway,
we're trying to train our ears, so I need to know what tuning I'm listening to. So I listen to all this music all the time, and I have no idea. I can speculate all day long.
Exactly.
You know, like I was just listening to Lois Lancaster's song, blah, 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 has a long name, starts with an R. And I think it's in the Bolan Pierce scale, but then because it says this album was written almost entirely in the Bolan Pierce scale. So when I'm listening to a song, I'm like, but there's a major third. I keep hearing this major third. I'm like, oh, well, maybe because she's playing that a trit of higher and this. And then I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure I heard another major third together. But then if it was just labeled, I wouldn't have to torture myself.
Yeah. Well, that's really advanced that you're picking that out and listening for like, tritive stuff, because I tried to listen to Lois's songs and figure out, like, notation, things like that, and I couldn't really, like, I couldn't get it on, like, my keyboard when I put it in Bolan Pierce. I should put my keyboard in 13 notes an octave and try and do Bolan Pierce that way, because I know, Elaine, that's kind of what you do. You and I have that thing where we take apart keyboards and rearrange them, so... I mean, how did you originally figure out how to rearrange your keyboards. You've got quite a few, right? Because you have keyboards that are dedicated to be in certain equal tunings, and mine, the one that I have changes tunings, sort of depending on the performance or what's going on. So how many keyboards do you have, and what are their names, and did you make them?
I'm showing my keyboards in this Skype video. Well, there's some.
Oh,
so I probably
beautiful.
Have like cool. 12 or 15 keyboards, and some of them are not put together. You know, so computer nerds will have computer guts everywhere. I'm like that with keyboards. So, and this
That's
one particular
fantastic.
Rather large closet here, there's a lot of keyboard guts everywhere. Keyboards with missing teeth. And then all my verticals that I actually use are just sitting right here. So I got a 10.
Oh, yes.
17, a 16, and a Bull and Pierce. Those are the ones I just showed you.
Oh, yes, because the Bull and Pierce has, you have little, like, black key structures, but they're painted, is it gray or white? The Dirt 2 mode, I think. Maybe I'm getting mixed
well,
up.
Well, my 16-note per octave one, I have disco keys.
Oh, yes.
The sparkly silver one, so I can tell where I am, but...
Yeah, those are the ones I'm referring to, yeah. That's a good idea. Maybe that would be the best way to deal with, symmetrical keyboard layout. My keyboard right now is in 15 equal, and I'm playing Christmas songs on it, but I have 8 white keys and 7 black keys, so I think maybe 7 black keys is at a point where it's a little bit visually dicey, and for some people, it's too many for them to, like, put their hand on it and immediately orient themselves to, like, the 4th black key or the 5th black key, you know? So, I don't know how many black keys.
Yeah, throw some nail polish on there.
Yeah, exactly. Could do that for some of the keys.
I like the sparkly kind because you can feel it too. It's kind of has a feedback on your fingers.
Oh, the like the glitter is kind of like rough
yeah.
a little bit. Yeah. That's pretty cool. So why do you advocate for the vertical keyboards? I know you have those on your website, but I never have like heard the pros side of that from you.
Well, I had a patent pending for 1 year, so this is what it was. It's very simple. When keyboard players perform on stage, it's always incredibly boring. Just because you can't see their fingers. They can't really run around unless they're using a keytar. A keytar has the downside of not having enough keys. So this is a way to have a full 88-note keyboard. So 88 keys is a little bit much. You can barely reach. But, you know, you can have a full keyboard and the audience can see it.
Okay.
And then the other upside... is that even though you have to play your left hand backwards, so you're holding the keyboard straight up like a cello, for those that don't know what we're talking about.
And right, then, yeah.
So your right hand's playing normal, your left hand's wrapping around backwards. I like it because it gives me that cool brain feeling of like writing backwards or trying to read something in a mirror. So my mom and I have done experiments where we're sight reading. So she's a really good sight reader. I'm a really terrible sight reader. But we could sight read almost equally well on the piano. And then we picked up a vertical and then tried the same thing on that. And so for classical musicians, it seems to be okay. There's just maybe a little learning curve. But my left hand just automatically, same thing with my mom, it just flips and I can just play. There's not much of a learning curve. Jazz pianists don't like it, from my experience, because they use too much muscle memory with the chords in their left hand. So the left hand being flipped is awkward. Where if the kid is learning, it would be easier, I think, because don't you remember that moment where you're like, oh, now I have to learn my left hand. The numbering's backwards. You know, it's like your thumbs are one, two, three, four, five, your pinkies. And then your left hand is completely backwards on the piano. So all the fingering is totally different. So it's 5-4-3-2-1-3-2-1 to play a scale, whereas your right hand is 1-2-3-4-5 or 1-2-3, whatever.
Also, when you have a vertical keyboard, you're saying that if you were to do something like play an F major scale, the fingerings would be the same for both hands.
Yeah. So for little kids learning, or adults, or anyone learning for the first time, they don't have to learn different fingerings for their left hand than their right hand. It's just weird for people that already play piano. But I personally like it. I like that weird feeling I get in my brain when I'm playing my left hand backwards. But I'm
what you need to do now, you need to create a vertical keyboard that's actually also an isomorphic keyboard, and then it's like perfectly identical in all keys and all hands.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ooh. So if I had all the money in the world, I mean, I'm pretty much devoting the rest of my life to trying to raise money, that's why I'm a landlord and trying to flip houses. I would never have done that other way. So I'm devoting my whole life to figure out how to raise money and make keyboards. So I'm just starting with the... I'm not actually starting with vertical keyboards. I'm starting with keys that are easily rearrangeable.
That's such an awesome idea.
I've explained that whole thing to Steven. So it's going to involve four white key shapes instead of seven. And it's completely unintuitive. That's and it involves having to be able to remove keys. And it took me like 8 years to figure it out. It was a mathematical problem.
Oh, right. We discussed this at Microtonal Adventures a little bit. I have multiple models of the same keyboard. So Ball State threw one of their keyboards in the trash, and I ended up merging it with a Korg IS-50, or at least the keys I got from the trash. So since they were both Korg, they were about the same. It's like Keenan Pepper's little YouTube video where he takes the springs out of the back of the keys. And does that, and all I had to do was shave off a little plastic nub from the bottom of the Korg keys while they were in the trash so that they would like match with the IS-50 keys. And then since the colors were a little bit different, I painted all the keys pink, because otherwise the Korg IS-50 keys were a little yellower, so it kind of looked like, in the early days, it liked to look like a mixture of like, you know, regular teeth and like dead old yellow teeth. It was like two different mouths combined.
I've had a lot of yellow keys in my life because I end up buying Imaudio keyboards that are broken because they're cheap, and then you get a million keys. Because if you try to buy keys one at a time, it's like $11.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's how I should raise my money. I should just sell all the keys I have one by one for $11 each. I would be totally rich.
To other microtonalists, make them pay.
So we've talked about keyboards. That's pretty fun. Maybe we could talk about how the challenges of live performance a little bit, because Elaine, I know you sing your own songs. So when you ear train your own songs, do you have like a routine for that? Because I've been trying to get people to xenharmonically ear train at Ball State, but it's so hard when they don't even want to do something as simple as like, you know, opening up a browser and playing with a tuning or even remembering what that is. I think most people think it's kind of like a fun thing and then they forget it right away. But I remember tuning stuff because I'm dealing with it all the time. And I think your songs are also like really teachable. So like there was one day in the Xenharmonic Alliance where we all like sang along to Avatar because it was 16.
Did you really?
Or at least we tried to. I was doing most of the singing. The Xenharmonic Alliance was keeping up pretty well, but there were some times when I had to like point out that, hey, this should sag a little bit, or this should be a little higher, things like that. So
Train my voice vocally with microtonal stuff. Zero, never. So what I do is...
Honesty.
It just doesn't seem like an issue because when you hear the song in the background, it gives you a framework, and then I just naturally fall on the right notes, I think. It might take...
Absolutely.
But when I'm recording the vocals, I definitely have a string patch blasting in my left ear of the... Let's see, which way do I do it? Yeah. So... I usually just have one headphone on and the other one open because I need to be able to hear my real voice from here to here. So I just have string patch blasting the melody I'm supposed to be singing. So I can kind of, you know, make sure that I'm on the right note. And then every now and then I'll, you know, there's no tuning software that's microtonal that I'm aware of. I probably wouldn't use it anyway. But every now and then, if there's a note that I'm like, that was such a good take, except this one note, and I'll pitch that note up just a hair or whatever.
Oh, yeah, there's Melodyne for that. I don't know if you've heard of it.
So my brother has Melodyne, and you can specify different tunings?
Yes, you can, and it's very easy. In fact, with Sevish's website, my Scala wasn't working, but I got it to work with that. And I can put any tunings in, and I can even do it with Melodyne Essential, which is just the like lowest level one that I think it cost money. I don't remember if it was free or not, but that's all I need to just drag things around and sort of fit them within the grid. I'm usually pretty happy with myself and how I've been singing, but occasionally, like, I have this song in 23 EDO that's an art song that's incredibly hard because it uses an 11-note scale. So when I put that into Melodyne, I was disappointed in myself, but
yeah, I think it would be good to just to check. I mean, I would try not to use it, but it would be interesting just to check. Like, what would I sound like if I was actually tuned?
Yeah, I usually don't use it to like cheat. Although Melodyne is really, really good, and you can't tell if you've moved it around unless it's a situation where you're actually just like saying a word and Melodyne thinks you've made like a giant leap in pitch. Then if you change it, it'll sound like you're saying the word funny.
Yeah, right. You know? The Cher effect, I call it, because back in the, what was that? The early 90s, when Cher first came out with that one song where she was using a pitch corrector on purpose as an effect.
Yeah, Believe, oh, right. Wasn't it?
So we always called it the Cher effect, but no one knows what that means anymore.
Yeah. I know you're writing a new album at the moment. Will that have vocals too?
No, because I'm trying to do it before Christmas. But I thought of putting some of Alice's little things in, like talking, you know, or singing.
Oh, yeah.
But so my last album was 2011. That was a really long time ago because I had a baby and I wrote a book. So that's my excuse. So
that's
it's
a good
been
excuse.
So long. And then, you know, now I'm taking care of my mom and Alice. I had too much anxiety about going into a composing trance, you know. I'm sure you know what I mean. Mm. You can't just compose on demand. So I have to put on my headphones and get to my zone. And then I was just had too much anxiety about, oh, what if I don't hear my mom's buzzer? Because I wouldn't hear it at all. Finally, finally, after months, literally, maybe I could say 2 years, I figured out, okay, if I put the thing right in front of me and I see the blinking light and I'm just going to use my earbuds for now so that I can hear it. Well, by the time I started composing, I did like 5 songs in a month and a half. I mean, I literally composed the 5 songs just like 2 days each. And then I've been messing with them, right? So that's unheard of for me. I usually take forever to write stuff and then even way more forever to sing it, write the lyrics, and then mix it. So like every 4 years I would have an album. Like I literally just like spit this out, 5 songs out, and they're almost done. And it's only been like a month and a half. So I don't know. I'm excited. I feel like myself again.
That is really fast. Yeah.
It is fast. Yeah, it's good. We'll get to hear more of your music again. So.
And you know how I said it was going to be a bit... chip music, like chip tunes, and I was gonna call it microchip. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what it is not.
It's not actually microchip.
It's not that at all. It's totally different because I can't control what comes out of me.
Right, so you start off with all the intentions.
Apparently I can't control what style of music I'm writing, so it's totally disco.
Yeah, I always get those ideas as well. Oh, wouldn't it be cool to have an album of all of this all in one tuning? Yeah, I'm never going to write an album all in one tuning. It's just totally impossible.
I really wanted to do that Boland Pearscale album before Heinz Boland died. Yeah, that's still never going to happen. But what came out of me was Donna Summer. Like total disco. It's hilarious. I think you'll like it. It's happy.
Will there be any live component to this new stuff? Or is it purely just you're making some beats at home?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I haven't really thought about that. I think what I want to do someday is flesh out the live show for Drums in Space that came out, you know, 2011, because that's supposed to be a space rock opera. So one, at some point before I die, there's either going to be a video version of the space rock opera that someone animates, or maybe Alice will end up being the lead singer for that.
Yes.
Probably won't be me by that point. But as far as performing live, I've somehow, I don't know if I've lost my passion for it, but I'm just so busy doing other stuff and kind of cozy and a little more, what do you call it, hermit mode than I used to be.
It's hard to fight that.
And I live in Las Cruces, New Mexico. There's not exactly a huge scene out here. I only have to perform when people drag my rear end out to these college, you know, conferences and stuff.
Well, that's pretty cool that you're still in conferences. Are you like kind of like putting yourself out there trying to get in, or
no,
do you find that the conferences are contacting
not.
You?
Yeah, both of those that I went to this year, I said no, no, no. So in 2017, like, they invited me to come out to UCSB and WWU. And both of those,
yeah,
I said, no, I don't think so. And then, was it you involved in asking me? I think it was you, too. Didn't I say no or eh or I don't know.
Well, I was super, well, I'm trying to remember. I wasn't, like, working for, I'm not working for the UN12 people, but, like, some people think I'm part of the board. I'm not.
I feel like you're one of the people that helped talk me into it. Or when you agreed to
perform
with me, I think that really helped. Because I didn't know who's going to perform with me. I don't have a live band anymore. And I'd seen you just jam out on any tuning. I'm like, oh, he can totally do it. Yeah, so it's literally them dragging me out of my cave. So no, I absolutely do not seek to do anything. And now some people want to fly me to Germany.
Whoa, will they pay for the flight?
Yeah. I still might change my mind. I'm still like,
That's a cool deal, though.
Yeah, yeah.
That
it is
great.
Well, I would
cool
do it
deal.
For Alice so she could see the world. And the beer.
That's cool.
Yes, good stuff. Yeah, that's very interesting because, like, I find that the microtonal people are really responsive, and they try to, like, get me to go to stuff. Like, Microtonal Adventures Festival was a result of that. They were like, hey, you should come to this, you should perform. But then with academic conferences that don't really care about that as much, I'm always having to put myself out there, so... I guess for that reason alone, I'd love to see more microtonal conferences, which I could run. So that would be fun. Yeah, and it was great performing with you at Microtonal Adventures. I think people should do more microtonal cover songs, you know? Like, since my keyboard's in 15, I've always wanted to cover my Zarian Porcupine Overture, which is where that whole name started. I think that would be really fun, but I can't get, like, a timbre on my keyboard that's jangly enough to match with Herman Miller's original MIDI masterpiece. So, but I'm working on it.
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of embarrassed to say the only songs I've done a cover of microtonally is...
Ooh.
Let's see. Video Killed the Radio Star, which was not my idea. Work for Love by Ministry.
I haven't heard of that. Am I out of the zeitgeist?
Work for Love. See, those are both Zia songs, and I think we performed them live like once, but they're out there on the internet.
Cool.
And then in DDT we did Vogue by Madonna.
Oh yes,
with Noel like screaming all like covered in fake blood and voguing. It was hilarious.
Awesome.
It's classic. Did you perform that in a different tuning?
Yeah, all of those were in 19 notes per octave, because that's the easiest way to do a cover tune. Just throw it into 19.
Oh, yeah.
And back when I used to use Vision, Studio Vision, you could just remap the notes really easily. I think even Performer, maybe. You could just have, like, all the notes, like, two columns, and you remap the notes to 19 and hit go, and all the MIDI notes go where they're supposed to go. So you could just record it in 12 and then remap it. And you just have to choose which third do I want. So you just have to adjust a couple notes here and there if there's a choice.
The chromatic ones, yeah. All right, well, that's really cool. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because as someone who's, like, eager to devour interesting microtonal software tips, I what you just described sounds so miraculous, and I have not really witnessed it in any capacity.
I can't find it anymore. Yeah, I can't find it anymore in any software. I should look around Performer again. My brother's we're always trying to get each other to use different programs. I tried to get him to use Pro Tools, and now he's trying to get me to use Digital Performer again, which I used to use a long time ago. So a Digital Performer might have it. Now I have a version of it. I should check that.
Ooh, yes, that would be a good thing to add in the microtonal web sphere, is how to do different mappings. I know that Reaper gives you different piano rolls, and I actually only know that, I think, because of Sevashir and Kite Gadratus.
Oh, so that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Sevash, do you remember how to do that? I kind of don't. It didn't work on my Reaper for some reason, but everybody else can do it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not a Reaper user. I didn't come up with the idea myself. I got that off of Kite. I mentioned it on my website, but I used Kite screenshots, so obviously credit goes to him for that. It's really cool that Reaper supports custom piano rolls. It's absolutely amazing.
That's great.
I get really confused because I do a lot of my composing on a piano roll. I don't really read notation. I kind of can a little bit if I focus. Treble clef is easier. The treble one is easier.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that would be really nice.
Piano roll, we need it.
I don't think I absolutely need it, but if it was there, it would definitely help. So I pretty much need a keyboard to begin with. So I need a real keyboard. That's why I make these things, to get all the notes in. But then I spend 90% of the time just in the piano roll manipulating it. And then, you know, yeah, obviously ignore what, you know, it's such a, you know, kind of vague. So it's not like when you're in the piano roll, you know, in Ableton or Pro Tools are the ones I've been using recently, you don't really notice where the black notes are in that piano roll. It just kind of looks like a bunch of notes. So it doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah.
But it would be helpful, because there are a lot of times where I have to hit the keyboard and see which note lights up over there and then fix something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not just that you need to ignore the kind of 12-edo layout that is kind of forced in the background, but it's also those nice convenient things they do, like if you press shift and up, for example, and it goes up an octave, which will be 12 steps, but then you're writing a song in 19 steps and you're using all 19 of those. So that's
right.
You get to the wrong interval. So you, I want to move this up one octave. I've got to press shift up, and then I've got to press up another 7 times. It's not
but
really...
what if you're in Bolin Pierce?
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
So, one tri-tape, please.
So I really think the world needs more tools for this. So, you know, the only thing I can have a handle on in my real life is hardware, you know, because I know how to solder and I like the hardware stuff. So that's why I've been, like, messing around with keyboards all these years. But if I ever finished, so if I finish this thing with the four brand new shapes of white keys and the rearrangeable keyboard, so I have to actually design a whole new keyboard base, which is exactly like, it can be exactly like a regular M-Audio KeyStation or whatever basic MIDI keyboard, but it has to have a few minor differences. So it's still going to cost a gazillion dollars to get that done. Then when I finish that, I'd like to move on to the reviving the Hexagon, because both those companies went out of business. And so many people,
right,
I can't
yeah.
tell you how many people say, don't bother with all that. You can use the Continuum or you can use an iPad. It's like, well,
right.
no, I
that.
Actually want to have hardware. There really needs to be, just like regular people have pianos and keyboards. Microtonalists, some microtonalists want hardware keyboards that they can, you know, play and put their body weight into it and perform on it, you know, not just.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'd like to get the Hexagon
Absolutely.
Thing worked out, where, you know, that needs to have some new updates. Like whatever new Hexagon keyboard comes out, they need to be able to light up. So the
What Terpstra's working on.
The old see-through Axis keyboards, you used to be able to just slide the key out. There was nothing holding them in. Like, literally, if you turned it upside down, they might fall out. That's how loose they were. But it was great. You could just rearrange the colors easily. And then when I got a hold of a new one, I'm like, oh my God, they're locked in. So you can still rearrange them, but it's a huge pain. And I always just thought, they just need to light up, obviously. They just need to light up and then have presets. So...
That'd be great.
Peter Davies, who had his company, he broke off from See-Through. He was the original inventor of that whole thing. And then he...
Oh, right. Yeah.
He's in London. And then he had The Shape of Music.
Oh, is he?
Peter Davies.
Cool.
He's a sweet British
man.
Yeah,
I've
love him.
Never...
But...
Cool. I'm in London, too. I should
Yeah, you need to
hello.
Meet him.
I've got...
You need to meet him. He might live right outside of London. I forget the name.
I've got an Axis 49.
I saw him last time I was in London, so... He'd love to meet
cool.
you. And if I could get it together, he would, you know, or probably anyone that would want to revive it, he would give his plans and all the spare parts and everything. Like, he's totally willing to let someone take up where he left off. But his life is kind of busy now, too. He's involved in other things. But, you know, so if all that ever got done, I think the next step would be software, because there's a million things I want. So, for instance, when I used to mess around, remember all those old videos I used to make of rearranging the hexagon keys?
I've seen that whole set of videos.
I have a lot of YouTube videos. I'm sitting in my pajamas with my cat trying to figure out how to rearrange them. And they're kind of dorky now looking back. Like, that was so obvious. Like, I spent so long trying to figure out how to arrange it for Bolin's Pierce, which seems silly now. But anyway, back then, I always wished there was some kind of an iPad or iPhone app where you could just say, this is the tuning I want. Now rearrange these hexagon keys in the best way, or show me 5 different ways. Because sometimes you need the whole row to shift over one, each row to shift one, which you can't really. So sometimes the actual MIDI note numbers need to be remapped on the hexagon keyboard. So anyway, there's all these issues that just take a lot of time and a lot of money to just get these new tools ready for people. You know, you can make phone apps for free. You can do certain things without all the logistics. But the things I seem to want to do just take money. That's why I'm holed up in Las Cruces trying to raise money. And people wonder, like, what the heck is she doing? That's what I'm doing.
Right, yeah. And it's so hard to create a market for those kinds of things, too.
Yeah, I don't even care. I don't really care about making money back. It'll end up in textbooks if I get it right. So that's good enough. For me.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
that's an amazing outlook, really. Yeah, that's cool. That you just want to do this for the sake of doing it, or because it's your passion.
I already know there's no market. So I've tried everything. Working with individuals. I even knew this guy that had a giant 1,000-square-foot machine shop in his backyard. It took him a long time to get the permits, but he had this amazing machine shop. So he worked for the Department of Defense, and he would make something totally amazing for $20,000, where normally they'd have to pay millions to Boeing, because he could design a circuit, build it. He had his little microscope glasses where he could solder the tiny, tiny things, and then he could mold the plastic mold, like, from beginning to end. His son was an electronic musician in his 20s that, you know, was like doing the synthesizers. So he was this perfect man that wanted to help me in his spare time. And we were getting pretty far with the vertical keyboard. He was like drawing it all up and all this stuff. But then all of a sudden he had to move overseas for some Department of Defense job. So I tried that. I tried makerspaces. I tried hiring people over the internet. I tried everything. Well, I finally, after all these years, and I'm done listening to people's advice, I found an engineering firm, because I've tried that too. I've tried talking to several engineering firms. I finally found one that I really jive with, and the owner is an electronic musician who uses Ableton and M-Audio keyboards.
Now, that's great.
Perfect.
They're called Kicker, K-I-C-K-R. It's like a cool, you know, cool name. But the ones that I talked to before these guys, every single engineering firm, the first thing they do is make you talk to their marketing department. So, have you thought of who your audience is? Have you calculated how many people might buy this and what the price range would be? And I'm like, oh my gosh, no. Can I just talk to an engineer, please? I just want to start doing it. I don't care about all that stuff. So when I talked to Kicker, the first thing I said was, hold on, let me talk first. I don't have a marketing plan. I don't really want a marketing plan. Maybe at some point we'll work that out. I just want to talk to an engineer. He's like, no, you're cool. I'm cool. I don't care. That's fine. I'm the owner, but I am an engineer. So you can start by talking with me. And he already uses Ableton and keyboard. So he already knew what I was talking about. Usually they have no idea what I'm talking about. I have to explain music keyboard. MIDI stands for musical instrument digital interface, you know.
13 notes? 14 notes?
So these guys I know, they have no idea what, like, how many notes per octave a keyboard. You can barely even get to talk to the person that cares about that. They just really force you to do the whole marketing plan. I finally know what I'm doing. I just need to keep feeding them money. Because it's already figured out. I already have it all mapped out, ready to go. So maybe, I'm trying to think, like, you guys would be fun. I just need someone to help me do like Kickstarter or Patreon would even be better.
Yeah, I think that would really that can really be a beneficial thing if your social media presence is really strong. Then a lot of people chip in. And Elaine, you also have like a scarcity advantage. Like, you have this huge body of work, and people haven't heard from you musically in a while. So if you start saying, "Hey, I'm doing this new music stuff," people are going to be like, "Whoa, yes," and probably want to donate. Whereas if somebody who drops music like every other week does that, then there's not as much of a chance that they'll get any attention because people are kind of used to it. I guess it's like the law of diminishing returns in action. But yeah, if you do that, we'll share it like crazy. I know I will at all the right times. So that would be great.
But I need you in the video going, "The world needs this keyboard." You know, because they have to be funny. Yeah, you guys would be perfect.
Right. Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to do like a Microtonal commercial where there's like this gray picture beforehand and you have a 12-tone keyboard and, you know, the announcer says something like, "Are you tired of not having enough expressive capability in your music?" Then, you know, and then it's like twinkles and romantic blur filters, and then you've got this new keyboard and it shows all the things happening, and it would be like kind of a humorous thing because you really wouldn't expect that. But yeah, and it might not even like have any marketing value at all. It just would be professionally produced and amusing, and then people might be a little bit interested. So you never know.
I knew you'd be perfect. Yeah, because the houses, the doing real estate is as slow as molasses, and the market's a little weird right now. So if I can just keep feeding them a little money at a time,
yeah,
that would be good.
Just keep them interested.
We'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
But yeah, I really hope this project takes off. We need these. We need this stuff. I think when we get our first like really good microtonal keyboards where you can actually see and touch the things, that's when the software developer is going to realize, oh, that's what you want your piano roll to look like as well, and then I'll be happy.
So
I want kind of depends on all of this kind of to happen.
Yeah, and there's dynamic tonality, which technically does that already, but it's a little bit cumbersome, and I actually, there's sort of like a DAW that comes with it that's made with MaxMSP, but you can't get audio out of it without like just recording the system audio itself. There's a lot of work to be done with the hexagonal layouts or various other layouts. I wonder if like everyone will get hexagonal and then my Halberstadt layout will seem like very like primitive in comparison. And it's like, oh, look at him. He has to change his tuning. So we have to wait half an hour while he changes the keyboard.
I don't think so, actually. I don't think you'll have that problem. There's something about the traditional kind of keyboard that you just can't get with the hexagonal keyboards.
Yeah, it's more familiar.
There's something really kind of body-ish about being able to touch them.
Exactly.
And,
yeah, it's just like Elaine said earlier.
To feel where you are, you don't have to look at the thing. The isomorphic keyboard is kind of halfway between a normal keyboard and an iPad to me, because the iPad, I don't get that, tactile feedback.
I've wondered if having the black keys slightly raised or something, but then it kind of takes away from the fact that you can switch keys without switching fingering is kind of a plus. So then I thought, well, if the black keys are raised up a little, then I don't know. Yeah, I've thought of that a lot. I think that's one of the main issues with the hexagonal is that it's a little nerdy. Mm. I've talked a long time to Peter Davies about my ideas for upgrading. And the first thing I always say is I think the keys need to be a little bit larger, just a tiny bit larger. But they worked so hard to find the perfect size that they were kind of stuck on that size.
Right.
He's like, trust that me, we made it a little bigger. We made it this and that. And this is the only size that seems to really work for a lot of people. But when I had my students try it out, they almost always said, I love this. I just wish it was a little bit bigger. Like the keys are bigger so I could put my body into it and not feel so nerdy.
That's interesting.
I know what you mean about the nerdy.
I think of it for myself, I think of it as a composition tool. It's kind of cool for performing at an academic conference. But if you're going to really rock out, it's kind of hard to run around the stage and rock out on a hex keyboard. But it's really good for composing. And in BP especially, or any tuning that's really hard, you find a good pattern and then you can just transpose up and down and make more out of it. I just think
that's
it's...
what I do. Yeah. Although I try not to do like just chunking one chord just down or up, because I feel like that's, well, this is common practice period theory kind of poisoning me a little bit. I feel like that's just a generally like elementary practice to just take a chord and just chunk it. So maybe I'll just take like, you know, if I have a triad, I'll take like a third and chunk it and then do something else with the other note that maybe is going up. So just generally using contrary motion and checking helps me avoid that. Sean and I were also talking about like how King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, when they did that microtonal album, so many people just, flooded the Facebook groups. So probably that means, in my mind, the best way to get people to play other tunings would just be to have like the right popular musicians just try it one time, which is what we observed with King Gizzard. So like, let's, you know, say that like Post Malone just next year was like, yo, I got this dope new track in 14 tone equal temperament. Y'all are posers if you don't know how to play this music. And that would be just imagine what would happen to the world because of that. There are just this small group of people who just have this really big voice because they got famous. So guess we gotta get famous, everyone. We're pretty much all kind of there. I think you two are more famous than I am, but I'm working on it.
All of us would get forgotten about, I think, as soon as someone did that.
Right, yeah.
Unfortunately.
So the 10 years that I taught electronic music, most of the students, or I would say a third at least, were DJ, you know, either wanted to be DJs or they already were DJs that were trying to come in and learn a little more technical stuff. And I tried every semester. I always gave my spiel where I talked about the 12-tone tuning and where the harmonics come from. And then that would lead to, you know, what if we used more harmonics to derive a tuning? We might have ended up with 19 notes per octave. And then I play something and I go through the whole thing. And then I end up playing on my music. And I say, I'm going to show you how to write. Because the requirement would be that they just would have to have 4 instrument tracks for the midterm. You know, a little minute-long thing. And I would always show Love Song. Because it's really simple. The way I showed how I composed that at the Microfest, remember? I showed Love Song.
Yeah, that
because
was
it's
great.
So simple.
With the diagrams, like, that was wonderful.
Like,
yeah.
I would have loved to have seen that, actually, because I've wondered about that song for a while, what some of the chords are.
Oh, yeah. I spent like 2 weeks coming up with 4 chords. that might be an exaggeration, but I spent a really long time coming up with 4 chords that sounded cool and jazzy or whatever they sound like, you know, and then just copy and paste it onto a bass track or a different, you know. But I would show the techniques of songwriting, and then kind of as a side note, oh, by the way, this is in a totally different tuning. In fact, this tuning doesn't even have octaves, and I'd give them a short little spiel about Bolan Pierce. And the whole point was, a lot of you students don't know any, you know, they don't know any music theory. A lot of them come in there, they have no musical experience whatsoever. And I would say, even though I have a lot of music experience in the Bolan Pierce scale, especially, I'm seriously just using my ear. I don't think of, I mean, I'm aware
That's
of the creative, I'm aware of things now, but certainly when I first started writing in it, it was like, I didn't know anything about music. Now I'm going to write a song. So, and this doesn't even have octaves, so that's even worse. So if I can do this, you know, you students can write, you know, you don't need any musical experience to mess around by ear and spend a really long time coming up with some nice lines or a couple chords. So I would sneak it in a number of ways, but it's amazing how few students would actually embrace it and want to do something.
Yeah, I think people see that it's a lot of work.
That was kind of my point, is it's really hard to get people to just randomly write in microtonal when it's already overwhelming enough composing in 12-tone.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you've got so many choices in any tuning, even in the really, really small ones, although your choices are certainly a lot more limited there. And the more tuning, or the more notes you have in a tuning, the more choices you have, and that increases exponentially. So yeah, I love your horizontal approach with Bull and Pierce. It sounds like by working with another tuning, your ear training chops and just musicianship chops in general probably went through the roof. So yet another good example of how microtonality is good for you as a musician, good for your listening strategies and, you know, sort of knowing where things go and end up. Because I sometimes try to write horizontally, but usually I have a vertical approach and then I tweak that based on like several different possibilities of what I could do. One particular instance being like puns on traditional chord progressions, which in Bull and Pierce, I guess you can kind of get that. Like with one of the cover songs I did, I did a cover of Your Love Song on YouTube. I hope you saw that. I don't know if you did.
Yes, but, of course.
I realized I sang it in the wrong octave afterwards and I was like, oh no, it's Bull and Pierce, so I'm technically an octave lower.
But you know, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. See, you just never think of octaves. They are so, like, we take them for granted as musicians. And I'm telling you right now, if you've never been in a non-octave tuning, just appreciate your octaves, cherish them every single day, never take them for granted, because when they are gone, your world is different. And you have to, like, as Elaine pointed out, worry about, like, the timbres and sounds being in the wrong octave and things like that. It's just crazy.
You know, one thing I don't worry about in BP is the odd harmonic thing. I mean,
interesting.
Oh, really? Yeah.
How many
don't
square
need to worry
waves
about that.
Can you listen to? I love square waves for video game music and for certain things. Square waves are awesome. But if you really think everything has to be triangle waves and square waves in Bull and Pierce, you're wrong. I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
But then that might be part of my other philosophy, which is just a normal philosophy of music. So all my life growing up learning music theory and 12-tone, the teachers always treated consonants and dissonance as an equal value.
Oh, my.
You know, whereas John Cage would say silence is just as important as music. You need the rests. You need the phrasing. You need dissonance and consonants, or you end up with just flat music that's not so three-dimensional.
Yeah, and there's also, of course, gradations of consonant and dissonant values and multiple meanings to the words, which is something that people gloss over in music theory, mainly, I think, because they don't have time, or at least most of the people I've met who are interested in, you know, higher order pitches or interesting timbres or things like that, they would love to talk about that stuff. It's just that they have to get through the material, so they have to present like this bland version of consonance and dissonance where it just refers to the interval and it doesn't have a context where something leads somewhere or the timbre
right.
plays a role.
Yeah, that's my main thing. It's about leading somewhere. It's about motion over time, not just one chord needs to be in tune and then the next chord needs to be in tune. Yeah, to me, it's way more about the interesting leaps between one note going to another, even if it's just one melody. To me, almost a microtonal melody is way more interesting and emotional than one chord.
Yeah, I am so with you on that. And I think the way something moves through time is also fundamental to the way we perceive Zen harmonics. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that if you hold one sound for enough time that the listener gets used to it, that it's not really Zen harmonic in that sense. So really, no interval is Zen harmonic if your ear has gotten properly used to everything. It's the movement of the structure and the placement of things that gives it that impression.
Yeah, but it's not music if we don't have time. It is one of the domains of music after all.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's very interesting stuff. I certainly would love to bring this up in like a music theory or ear training class. Ear training is hard to teach, though, so when I was teaching it, I only brought it up occasionally as a fun thing, like, well, you can talk to me after class if you want to know more about 15-tone equal temperament. And by the time I'm done saying it, everybody's out the door. But, interesting stuff. Yeah, I should have brought my keyboard to class more often. I did bring it one day, but we didn't really get to use it. It was kind of like set up in the corner of the room, and some people played it afterwards. It was actually set up in 10 in preparation for Microtonal Adventures, where I played your music, Elaine, because I was looking at all the 10 patterns, and they're all pretty interesting. I think the songs that you wrote in 10. Yeah, 10 is surprisingly, I think, easy to grasp.
People used to make fun of me for using 10, or they would think, oh, she doesn't know what she's doing. Really? She uses 10. Why would anyone use 10? Oh, really? It's so... But just I love the keyboard, the way it has just the three black notes. And then if you play, that's the diatonic scale I like, where it's like white, white. So it's half step, whole step, half step, whole step, half step, whole step, half step. So it's like, da, da, da,
right.
Da, 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 da. I have no idea if I really sang it.
That sounds right.
Whoa, I think I did. My voice is shattered. But
yeah, that's a good strategy for that. Is like, if you think of a hexatonic scale, but add an extra note.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, so it's an 8-tone diatonic scale with the three black notes.
Wasn't it sevens? It's seven notes, right?
Well, seven, yeah.
Or seven unique notes.
Sorry, I was
seven
counting.
Unique notes, and then it lands on an eighth note, which is an octave higher than the first note.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's really interesting. I've used that scale in 10 as well. It tends to be my go-to scale. I've only written one thing in 10, which was a really long, like, chromatic journey. So... not nearly as, like, you know, digestible as your 10 stuff, which I think, like, the stuff you've made in 10 is a really good showcase for, like, what can be done with chord progressions to make it really palatable. So, you know,
everything I write ends up having
really
to be a pop song structure. First bridge, chorus, breakdown, bridge, chorus. I can't help myself because
that's okay.
Being
it's
from
appealing.
The 80s and... You know, listen, growing up with Cyndi Lauper and Billy Idol and all that stuff, I've always had a love and appreciation of pop song structure and how incredibly difficult it is to write a really, really catchy bridge and chorus. So
yeah,
a really good
hard.
Pop song.
Very difficult.
If anyone, I don't even really like Top 40 that much, but I listen to it a lot. A really, really good pop song. The bridge gets there and you think it's the chorus. Nope. And then the chorus comes and you're like, wow, that's so strong. And all my life, I've never been able to write a song as strong as some of the ones I hear. Maybe because I don't like them as much. I kind of like sounding a little more underground. I just can't help it. But I'm always locked into this pop song thing. And it's just something ingrained in me that I've always been really interested in. So, but I don't listen to it. What I listen to is stuff like Sevish writes. That's why when you came along, Sean, I'm like, whoa, I'm freaking out. Someone's actually writing microtonal music in the style that I already listen to. Like, that's what it's I listen to at home. I don't listen to pop stuff. In the car, I always end up on the Top 40 station because Alice wants it.
Right.
Because I used to always just play 70s music, or then I'd go to the 80s station. I'd go between 70s and 80s. If I'm in the car and I have the radio, like, I'm 70s, 80s. So she knows really well now. She can tell if it's 70s, it's groovy or whatever. If it's 80s, it's urgent. Every 80s song is like urgent.
It's a good ear.
But so she knows and she can tell it's not produced that well. So she knows right away. She's like, Mom, can you put it on the news station? But it's good exercise for me, especially when I was an electronic music teacher. It was always good exercise to listen to that stuff so I could figure out what are they doing with sidechain compression? What are they doing with production techniques kind of thing?
Right, yeah. It's really beneficial when you can hear that, because I should do more sidechaining, but, like, Elaine, your songs are really well-mastered and all of that stuff. Do you usually do your own mastering, or does somebody else do it? Or do you even really make a conscious effort to, like, boost the loudness of the tracks so that it
Let
all
me
sounds
tell you
really,
about mastering.
Like... Yes.
You can tell how
Go
thrilled
ahead.
I am about mastering. So,
oh, boy.
I've always gone by the notion that you shouldn't master your own stuff. So I always take it to a studio and always have my friend, or, you know, it's been different people over the years, but, you know, to have someone master it properly for radio as if it's ever going to be on the radio. And I just spend the whole time yelling at them, please take off the compression. I can feel it. My ears are hypersensitive to compression. Like, so side chaining's cool and all that. I've actually used a lot of side chaining in this new album, which I haven't really used before other than in subtle ways, but I'm using it a lot in this. But just compression as far as mastering, like the whole thing is compressed. Track is just compressed a lot, my inner ear, I just feel it. I can just feel my eardrum like being sucked in and out. It's terrible. I just can't stand it. So I'm like, that's too much compression. Mm. And it always takes off the attack of my chunky bass lines, you know, my hardware synthesizer is super chunky, chunk. It's like, it just ruins it, everything. So I spend all kinds of money and time yelling at this mastering engineer. And they're always like, go away, go home, Elaine. Let me just do it. And then I come back and I get it and I listen to in my car and I'm like, this is terrible. I hate it. And then I don't use it. And then I release the completely unmastered version. Every album has been like that since 1991.
Wow. That's really interesting, because I always think that everything sounds kind of like it was mastered, or at least everything I've heard from
most
you.
Most of it's not even compressed overall. That's so terrible.
Well, that's good, yeah. Because
I can't stand
that can be good.
I'm going to do that with this album.
This is the thing.
Because this album is the first one where I'm in the world of Ableton and software synths. So I know this is hard to believe. Well, you probably already know this, but Drums in Space was all hardware synths. I think I used a couple of samples here and there that I found in some plugin, like little noises, but the synthesizers are all hardware. One of them is even the Moog Chronic 6, the Moog Sonic 6. They used to call it the Chronic 6. That comes in a like a coffin. You open it up. And it's got the keyboard on the bottom and the knobs embedded into the lid of the case. And there's no MIDI, so you can't sequence it. So I recorded playing a bunch of stuff on that. So it's serious, like, hardware synths on Drums in Space.
Mm. That's amazing. Yeah.
And so I was really snobby about, like, not snobby, but really, I didn't want to mess with the sounds. I'm like, I'm using these old synths. I want to leave them pristine. And the compression and mastering, all this crap is, like, messing it up. So, but now that I'm doing this whole album in Ableton with my plugins... I love Morphox, by the way, because you can put it on a tuning and then scroll through the sounds in the tuning. Every other synth, you have to pick a sound and then get your tuning map after the fact. Horrible.
Yeah. There are a few that do it right. I have seen a few that do hold their tuning.
But, tell me what they are.
Big problems there. What is it? That guy, Yuhi.
Yeah, Yuhi. Zebra?
Urs Heckman?
Wait.
Yeah, Diva can do that. What will happen Zebra is won't. If you try to change your preset, it will lose the tuning. But if you go onto the tuning selector, right-click it, and then do hold. It's hold or something, then there's a little padlock there. And you can do that with any parameter on the synth. If there's any parameter you want to hold, and you can scroll through those presets.
Oh,
it's good stuff.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. I love you. Now I'll be able to write way more fast. Because it takes so much time to go pick a sound when you can't just scroll through. You know, I sequence a line, and then I'll like to let it loop while I scroll through sounds. The most obvious thing to do. Oh, that's great. Thank you. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
No worries.
You know, that also...
Been geeking out too hard over here.
Right click. You know, as an Apple user, I forget to right click sometimes.
That also could be good for polysystemic music. I don't know if either of you do that,
polysystemic?
Yes, I don't do that vertically, and I don't think it's generally a good idea, because you could just describe it as one tuning system, just like how in polytonality you can describe things as one chord. But I guess a polysystemic music would be music that changes tuning systems, either like within the middle of the work or maybe sporadically. So I definitely want to do a big crazy piece where like it's really, really polysystemic a lot, like changing tunings every bar. But I don't know what on earth I'm going to do for that. Maybe something like that where, like, I can, you know, get my computer to click the change tuning button in, like, a certain pattern or something like that.
That'd be cool, yeah. I've had some ideas about doing things like that as well, but it's difficult to realize that kind of stuff quite often with the tools we got. There are ways, but, you know, a lot of workarounds, a lot of hacky stuff That's the kind of world we live in. Microtonal composers, we're always hacking at things to make it do the most simple of.
It's amazing the amount of extra work you have to do. But let me tell you, it's way easier now than it was in 1991. Because back then it was all hardware. And just like now, it was really hard to find a synth that would let you do it. And if it did let you do it, it wasn't necessarily because they programmed it to do microtonality. A lot of synthesizers would have... So even in the software synth, this is true. A lot of them will have a way to do a kind of a microtonal thing. But the programmer was thinking more along the lines of making like tablas or like drums a different tone. So...
I see.
You might be able to find a tuning on the limited presets they give you that would work. So
right, yeah.
I like the Roland. I used to use a Roland D110, and there was just limited tunings that it would let you select. So it was kind of totally arbitrary. And one of them happened to be 19, and one of them happened to be 10. That's why I used those early on was because those were one of the only ones that made any sense that I could make my synthesizer do.
Okay, I see. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that. That shocks me that 10 would be, like, one that it just had. Because it seems that, like, on most hardware synths that I know about that I've just tinkered around with either at Ball State or, like, at friends' houses, the default synth tunings that happen are usually, like, mean tone temperaments or, like, things that play nice major and minor chords that aren't really Zen harmonic very much. Like 19 is a good example, 31 equal, and like just tunings and well temperaments and things like that.
So that's the other thing I was going to say. If it did let you do microtonal stuff, it would be that, what you just said, not really be open.
Yeah, yeah.
So whereas the Yamaha TX81Z I had, or the Yamaha DX7, you know, that would have an open tuning where you could program every single note. And then I'm thinking, well, this is great, but can't we just have something... My whole thing about, can't we just have one knob where it anchors on C?
Tune everything to C.
So then finally I'm like, okay, fine. We'll have three, instead of one knob where you just do a equal temper tuning, always anchored on C, we could have three fields. One where you say what you want the frame to be, which would usually be an octave, but it could be whatever. And then the other one to say how many notes, and then the other one to say what note do you want it anchored on, which should be totally open, which really would just be C or A440, but just leave it open. So three fields. There. All the world's problems are solved. But no one ever listens to me. So eventually they come up with, you know, these guys that have to be so complicated about everything. They make tuning maps, which that's great. Now I really enjoy tuning maps. And I've got my whole collection.
Tuning maps are fun.
Yeah,
but scary.
They're good.
Yeah.
But a part of me will always be like, why couldn't we just put three fields? Then you don't have to worry with, you know, dig around and ask your friends, can I have a scalophile? I don't really want to.
Yeah, but how are you going to do five limit JI?
Oh, okay, sorry. That was the equal temperament Elaine Walker speaking. Right.
Hey,
yeah,
I love equal
that was always
too.
The problem because...
It's okay. I don't want five limit JI.
Most people aren't just always stuck to equal temperaments like I am.
Oh, I love equal temperaments. I think they're easier because, like, with JI, there's this whole explanation attached, and by that time, the musician you're trying to convert has tuned out. But with equal temperament, it's just like, look, I've got more dots in a row. And they're like, oh, okay. So, I mean, I just think that's way easier. But yeah, there's a lot of merit to JI. I'm also thinking of unequal scales. That approach doesn't work for unequal scales. So whenever I do an unequal scale, that's basically the only time that I have to use mappings. Like for my Christmas album again, since I'm plugging it too much already, I'm using Whitewood 15. I'm using Whitewood 14 with an extra note, so it's not a moment of symmetry. So I just did that so I could play it on my 15 formatted keyboard in 21 tone equal temperament and just play 15 of the notes. So usually I'm thinking of a subset of an equal temperament when I do something like that and not JI.
Oh, right.
But yeah, those would be kinds of the situations where that wouldn't work. Absinthe from Native Instruments also has it does exactly that. It just has those three fields, but it has octave size as a parameter, and it's written in semitones. So if octave size is 12, that means an octave is 12 notes, but it only changes that interval.
See, I find that really confusing. I'm already confused.
It's actually not that bad.
So
I have a video on it.
They mean whether it's a 2-to-1 frequency ratio or slightly different, or do they mean how many notes per octave?
They mean how many notes per octave, but then it doesn't change any of the notes in between unless you do my trick, which is to make the octave one key, and then you make the octave amount a fraction of an EDO, and then it changes the whole keyboard automatically. Because, like, normally if you just have an octave, it would just, like, you know, if you change the octave length to 13, it would just change the size from 12 to 13, and then you would just have...
See, the fact that they call it octave bugs me.
Yeah, it's weird.
This is making everyone want to be a microtonal musician.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I forgot. I shouldn't say that, because then people will be like, oh, this is crazy. But yeah, no, my YouTube video is really easy, so it took me a long time to figure it out, but it's actually, like, you can totally do that without Scala or anything.
I'm going to call it Skula. Oh, I'm going to come up with another name now.
Skula, the third pronunciation.
Scala.
Scala. Skalu.
But it, yeah, so we should definitely tell everyone our YouTube channels for our tutorial videos. So, because I don't even know what is yours, Steven?
It's just my name, Steven Weigel, and there's this very grainy picture of me playing a human computer interface that I made where you can barely see that it's me. I might change that picture, but it's, you know, it's so fun. So, yeah, that's mine. I mostly have music theory videos and some cover songs. And then, Elaine, yours is,
I figured out how to make it my name. So now you can just write youtube.com Elaine Walker.
Oh, yay. Awesome. So that's yours. And then, Sevish, yours is, Sevish Music on YouTube, right?
Yeah, I think it's Sevish Music. So what's that? youtube.com/Sevish Music. I can't remember. If it's not that, you can go to sevish.com/YouTube. You'll be redirected to whatever the correct thing is, and that's the same for all of my socials. It's just the easiest way to do it.
Okay, that's fantastic. Since we're already sort of on the topic of promoting social media, I guess we can sort of call it right here and talk about exciting new opportunities for the podcast. I think we're gonna try and release episodes once a month, generally, but maybe not always. This has been our first episode with a guest. Thank you so much, Elaine, for being on.
Thank you, Elaine.
Elaine's got a new album coming out, Microchip. So
it's not called Microchip, so this is the first time everyone will learn the name. Because as I said, when I started composing, not one chip came out. It was not chippy at all. It was total disco. So
oh, okay. I guess I didn't know you changed the name.
I've changed the name. So when I get in bed late at night, I like to watch science-y videos and learn about space and stuff. So I've been learning about space-time, my favorite topic. And there's something called four momentum of space, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. But
oh, okay.
If you Google four momentum, so the number four or the word four dash momentum, you can learn about it. And I just thought that'd be the perfect name for this, because that was the topic of space I was learning during this whole time I was composing. So it must have been influencing me somehow. Ooh. Plus, it's all in 4/4 and it has momentum.
So there's still a big space influence in your work then, yeah?
Well, that's great. Okay, then that's Elaine's new album, For Momentum, which will be coming out soon, so stay tuned for that. I'm Steven Weigel.
I am Sevish.
And you can find our podcast on nowinzen.libsyn.com. You can also find it on Spotify, and hopefully we'll be getting to iTunes soon. We're working on it, so
yes.
Go ahead and stay tuned. You can also give our Facebook page a like, as well as our Twitter and YouTube pages.
You can also send us feedback.
Yes.
Send us lots of feedback. We want to get better and make it a really nice microtonal show for you all to enjoy.
Yes, the perfect show. Okay, well, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.
We'll see you all later. Bye-bye.
Over and out.